Hello and welcome to another episode of Sons of Ignatius podcast. I'm Father Niall Leahy. I'm the parish priest here in Gardiner Street Parish in Dublin, Ireland. And this is the first episode we've done in a good while. I suppose you could call this maybe the beginning of season three of our podcast. Took a good long summer break and it's been on my mind to get back into doing episodes again. So here we are back with a bang. I'm really, really happy to introduce Sean McMahon today. Sean is a Jesuit novice. He's a second year Jesuit novice. And we might just get into explaining what a second year Jesuit novice is. Sean, welcome. Welcome to the podcast. Great to chat to you. Sean, what's a second year Jesuit novice?
Sure. Thanks very much for having me on, Niall. Yeah, a second year novice is, I suppose you could say that I'm at the start of a long Jesuit road. When one first enters the society, one enters the novitiate, which is a 2-year period of, let's say, of both formation and probation. As such, it's an opportunity both to cultivate your vocation while also testing it as well. And so I've just kicked off my second year. And I suppose you could divide it up into three different times. There's your Ordo Solitus phase, which is everyday community life, everyday prayer life, and everyday study life. There's also the experience of the spiritual exercises, which is 1 month spent mostly in silence, working through and praying through the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. And then there's the long experiments, such as the hospital experiments, such as the fast food experiment, and the pilgrim experiment, which I believe it will be the subject of our conversation today.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about we're going to get to your pilgrimage experiment. We had, as our regular listeners will know, Eamon Walls, SJ, was on this podcast previously sharing about his pilgrimage experiment. And Sean, you've just completed yours and you have survived the pilgrimage experiment.
Yes, well, against all the odds. Yeah.
Of course, then have to have you on and talk about it. I think of all the stories that people share about their time in novitiate, it's the pilgrimage experiment which always comes to mind and which stays with you. It's an incredible experience. Before we get to that, Sean, would you mind just saying a little bit of like what you were doing before you entered the society and how it was that how you found yourself to be a novice in the society?
Sure thing. Well, to put it in Jesuit terms, I suppose I had my first cannonball moment or my first encounter with my vocation back when I was a student at Clongowes-Wood College. It was there that I had the great pleasure, actually, and the great privilege of meeting your good self while you were a scholastic. That was over the course of my final 2 years. And it was through my involvement with the liturgy in Clongowes where I first had that moment of realization of, yeah, this could be it. This could be something that I'd be pursuing. This is something that I should definitely keep thinking about. Now, at that time, I was in my final year, Leaving Cert was coming up. So I thought, right, I have the plan for university. I've been in a boarding school for 6 years. Mm-hmm. I haven't really seen much or had much experience of the actual big bad world outside. So I thought, I'll leave this now. I'll keep thinking about this, keep this in the background, keep to the plan as normal, and then put it in God's hands. And I had a great freedom in doing that. I then went over to the UK where I studied science for 3 years, followed by a 1-year master's in the history and philosophy of science. And yeah, throughout this time, it was something that never went away. And I mean that in the best of senses. It was something that was always either gnawing at me or something that was always kind of provoking this is something you need to look at. This mm-hmm. is something you need to really pray about. And something that I realized in my final year, certainly, I need a bit more help with, need a bit more help discerning. And so it was in my final year, just as COVID was all kicking off, that I reached out to yourself and I reached out to the Irish province. And we began a formal discernment period for about a year and a half, 2 years, including the application. And during that time, I was working in London, just in one or two roles in kind of tech companies as that boom was taking off, kind of sales-based, consultants-based roles as well. But there was no real long-term plan with those, as lots of that point had been geared fully towards discerning my Jesuit vocation. And then that ended up with me kicking off my novitiate here in Innsbruck over in Austria, which I think was a surprise to everyone involved.
So it sounds like that call was ever present, like no matter how, like your circumstances changed there, you know, a few times. So boarding school, then university in the UK, and then working in London. So living three very different lives. And yes, it was just a sense was there all along that you were called to the priesthood and religious life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. One could almost say I grew up within it in a sense, in very much going from kind of mid to late teenage years into my early 20s, that very formative period where, as you say, there's changes in location, changes in pursuits, changes from various forms of study to then formal employment, different countries and different contexts. And it was something that just remained ever present with me throughout. And certainly when we began the discernment process, it was something that then began to really kick into gear. And I could feel a real momentum coming in, especially once I'd been accepted and we were planning towards kicking off in September of last year.
Yeah, so last summer, I remember we were discussing, okay, where would you do the novitiate? Because normally from the Irish province, our novices would be sent to Birmingham, which is where I did the novitiate. But because of COVID, there were no other novices ready for our candidates ready to go to Birmingham. So we had to look around, and the options, I suppose, were the United States or Austria. And seeing as you had some German, you manfully volunteered to go to Austria. I thought,
I remember making that as a joke at the time to yourself and our former provincial, that I know what we had our sights set on initially on America, because naturally it would be the same language. But I remember throwing out, just in case this all falls apart, guys, just I did a bit of German for the leaving cert, but I'm sure we won't need to come to that in future. And then the call came before where we said, yeah, Sean, I'm afraid with everything with visas and COVID for America, that just won't be a runner. You did say that you had a bit of German from a few years back, so how can we make use of that? And here we are later.
your leaving cert German teacher would be so proud of you, Sean.
Absolutely delighted, I'm sure.
So, and I've been over to visit you in Innsbruck, and it's a really beautiful place, and you've got excellent brothers there with you in the novitiate, and your novice master is a very good man as well. It's a nice setup. Yeah, as you said at the beginning, the novitiate kind of has sort of three different gears as such. There's the everyday community life when you're praying and learning and discussing things there, growing in your knowledge of the Jesuit way of life. Then you have the spiritual exercises, the long retreat, 30-day retreat, which deserves another episode of its own. That's a whole other thing. We might get to that another time. But that's absolutely foundational for us as Jesuits. And then the experiments, I'm doing quote unquote experiments, that's Jesuit lingo. I guess for sort of like immersive experiences, you use the word probation there at the start. So it's really a test, like different tests as to can this guy cut it when he's thrown out of the novitiate and kind of told to survive, whether it be in a nursing home or out in the road or in a hospital or some kind of social outreach or a parish. And one of the standard ones is the pilgrimage. So again, just please, for our listeners, we'll just explain what's the basic idea behind the pilgrimage experiment.
Sure. The basic idea, coming directly from Ignatius, is that novices will spend the period of around a month or 4 weeks at least on the road between two points, without money, without a tent, without any kind of phone or communicative device. And the idea is to put ourselves totally at the mercy of others, let's say, and put our faith totally in God that we're going to be okay. Yeah, and it really is that idea of saying we have no means ourselves to look out for ourselves. We don't know where our next meal is going to come from. We don't know when it's going to be. We don't know where we're going to sleep tonight. All we know is we have a goal in mind to reach at the end of this month. And we're just got to put our faith in God and also trust in the charity of others to help us on our way to get there.
Yeah. So no money, no sleeping bag, no phone, just relying on the goodness of strangers and God's providence for getting by. And you made it. So obviously, you know, we can say with total confidence that this story ends well.
Absolutely, but that's good. Hopefully no spoilers, but virtue of this episode, it's good news.
The story ends well, but that's not to say that your walk was without incident. And sorry, just thanks for bringing up the point there about Ignatius, because you are, as novices on pilgrimage, really are following in the footsteps of Ignatius, who did walk the roads of Europe when he was in those early years of his vocation. He was walking from Spain to Paris and up to England as well one summer. So Ignatius was a walker.
Absolutely. He was a man on the road. And I think it really is a wonderful blessing in the novitiate that it's not just a case of we're learning about Ignatius and we're praying in the way Ignatius recommends or taught, but we're actually doing the things he did and we're living in a manner similar to him and we're taking inspiration from him as well. And we're putting ourselves into those same positions as well to conform ourselves to that in a way. And so that was a wonderful source of prayer at the start, throughout, and then a great source of reflection as well afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, so back to brass tacks. Where did you start? Where was your destination?
Sure thing. So we started in Zurich in Switzerland, and with the goal in mind of walking around 520 kilometers northwest, roughly, to finish in Paray-le-Monial in France.
Paray-le-Monial, which is the shrine to the Sacred Heart in eastern France. And who was your companion?
My companion was my fellow now second year novice, Conrad Glosemeyer. And it was his idea, actually, and it was his inspiration that we picked this route. You're very right to mention that it's the center of the Sacred Heart devotion, something that's very important both to the society. And also, the planning took place in the month of June, which, as you know, is dedicated to the Sacred Heart as well. And when all of these kind of factors came together, we'd heard from other Jesuit scholastics that Paray-le-Monial is a fantastic pilgrimage spot, and it would just be a wonderful place to do in the month of June and July to reach us out with that in mind. And we just thought, yeah, let's seize this opportunity. Let's try and make this work. There were no official pilgrimage ways coming from, let's say, the Central European area over to Paray-le-Monial, but in either a sheer burst of optimism or a bit of naivety, we just thought, we can find something ourselves. We can make our own way there. We can put something together using Google Maps, and I'm sure we'll be fine.
So I'm imagining the planning was like, okay, so you start at like Paray-le-Monial, and then you just draw a line kind of 500 kilometers eastwards, and you go, right, where does that get us? Was that your starting point?
Pretty much that was exactly it. We began with the finish line in mind, and we looked 500 kilometers. Yeah, we drew a circle, and then pulled up the train timetables from Innsbruck to see what would get us somewhere in the most direct route.
Yeah.
So Zurich was the winner. We were completely either oblivious or ignorant of the fact that the Jura Mountains stands directly in between Zurich and Paray-le-Monial. But once we realized that, we tried not to let that faze us.
This is sounding more and more like sort of like the Tour de France or something. Like Giro d'Italia.
Exactly.
So it was a bit of an endurance test as well, getting over those mountains. Okay, we've got to talk about a few things here, but like, can we start with the physical aspect of it? That sounds like physically a challenge. How was it for you walking, whatever, 20K a day over a mountain range, all sorts of weather? And you're a fit guy. Like, you played rugby for Clongowes and Cambridge, and yeah, you're still in good shape. So what was that like?
Yeah, I went in with high hopes for myself. I won't lie. I'd say at the start of novitiate, I wasn't much of an endurance man, but because of the prevalence of the mountains here and the fact that it's very much the culture, especially in Innsbruck, we often find ourselves hiking up in the mountains once every 2 weeks, let's say, just on our billet day off. So we'd also done a bit of long distance training, so to speak, kind of haphazardly in advance, just to try and break in either the new hiking shoes or to get used to carrying a pack. But there was really no preparing for when you were facing into, let's say, a 6 to 7 hour hike up through the Jura Mountains. You've got a 10 kg pack on your back. You didn't sleep the night before and you haven't actually eaten yet this morning. Not to mention it was about 35 degrees. So as a fellow Irishman, I'm sure you can, I'm sure you can realize that we're not built for the extreme heat. Yeah. So the physical aspect was tough, and it's not just because of it's taking place over 4 weeks and you're walking a minimum of 20 to 30 kilometers a day. That does build up after time. And if you don't keep an eye on yourself, you don't keep an eye on preventing things like blisters, if you're not keeping an eye on all the things you need that you can usually take for granted in your day to day, like food and sleep, then things can get really hairy. I mean, even for myself on day 4, I thought I was pretty well equipped to handle at least the terrain, but I ended up falling quite badly and rolling my ankle, which unfortunately, because we were already in the mountains and we were walking through a pretty rural part for the following week, it meant there was at least 5 days before we could get our hands on any pain relief and another 2 before we could get our hands begging for anything substantial from a pharmacy. So The physical aspect was certainly an ever-present part of the experiment and something that a lot of the times with good planning we could work around, but at the end of the day, sometimes it just had to be a grit the teeth and just put one foot in front of the other or limp one foot in front of the other, as it was for the first week for me.
Was it like up down, or was it like up 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 and then down 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 down, or
Yeah, it was up, up, down, 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 up. And then if some days, because there was the constant need to get food, of course, and but at the same time, couldn't risk bringing too much with us or it would slow us down. It was always the case that we'd climb up a bit of the mountains and then come down the other side to a town, then back up again a bit and then come back down again. It was crisscrossing so for the first week, 2 weeks. Once we broke free of the kind of the Jura range, things flattened out once we got into France, but it was certainly it wasn't just a straight up and down, unfortunately.
Were you at any point, were you worried that you wouldn't make it or you'd have to stop?
Yeah, and more than once, frequently there were times where we realized, oh, we're going to have to take a risk here and say, right, we're out of food, no one has, we haven't been able to find help in this town. Either we keep going and then risk all sorts, risk not making to the next destination, risk running out of water, or we stay here and hope for the best. But there were other times, of course, where we were up in the mountains and we thought, right, do we keep going? Do we come down? And of course, in this time, we don't have a phone that we can just quickly check Google Maps and see, right, how far away are we? Or there was no call, quickly calling and jumping down into towns and things like that sometimes. So it was a constant stream of improvised decisions, a constant stream of talking to my co-novice Connor and saying, right, what do you think we should do here? What are our options? Every day brought its new adventure and brought its new challenges, I'd say.
And for decision making, were you always of the same mind pretty much? Because like, how do you, like, no one can pull rank as such, can you? Like,
Well, actually, that's where we decided to implement. We took some great advice because you're absolutely right. The danger of having two people making a trip like this is that one person could say A, the other person could say B. And then, especially when hunger kicks in, when you're sleep deprived, when emotions are high, both digging your heels in wouldn't be unheard of. So we implemented a system of day superior, where each day someone would take turn essentially breaking the deadlock and making the final call. Now, we certainly prepped doing something like that in advance, and it never became a point where someone would just start giving orders or saying this, that, or like some kind of canonical form of obedience that we were inventing as we went along. But that got us out of a lot of really dicey situations where we were often picking between two options that were either equally bad or equally at least would have gotten us to our end goal, but just different challenges depending on which route we took. And that just meant that at no point did we ever waste time, or did we ever do one thing and then
Very
regret it
good.
and then try to do the other, because that was a lesson we learned early on day two, where we hadn't really thought to implement this properly and we were still a bit new to the whole situation. And a journey between kind of the outskirts of Zurich and then Brugg that should have only took 20 kilometers suddenly took 35, because we weren't talking, we weren't paying attention to things. And so we learned from that. And that obviously had a knock-on effect on what we could do the following day. Adding 15 kilometers out of nowhere is going to take its toll.
And then where did you end up sleeping? Were more nights kind of indoors or outdoors? Was it cold at nighttime? Maybe you could say, like, what was your most luxurious sleeping night arrangement, and what was your roughest sleeping arrangement?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so just taking a view over the whole month, we slept everywhere and anywhere. We had the privilege sometimes of being brought inside and being shown some fantastic hospitality by people who did not know us. I should say as well, it's one of the rules that we're not allowed to introduce ourselves as Jesuits. Now, if that comes up later down the line, sure, then certainly we wouldn't be lying to anyone, and we wouldn't be needlessly trying to mislead or talk around that. But
So
certainly from
how did you
London,
introduce yourself?
depending on where we are, either in of Deutsch or French, we would just say, hello, we're two pilgrims without money. Would you possibly have a piece of bread or a place for us to stay tonight, if that would be okay? And then from there, we try and get a conversation going. We'd be happy to share more. We were surprised how quickly people helped us just without really asking too many questions about who we were or what we were about. It would always become quite apparent, especially when we were invited inside for a meal or invited to stay the night somewhere, that someone would eventually put it together and say, okay, hang on, you're Irish, you're German, you live in Austria, but you're walking from Zurich to France. Just unpack that for us. You're not stupid. You're not employed. What's going on here? And then, of course, you know, the big reveal would come after
the
that.
Big reveal.
But
have you seen the Jesuiten?
Nous sommes
des Jesuites. Voilà.
Voilà. Absolutely. And I suppose they were the nights that we had the privilege of staying inside. There were plenty of other nights. I mean, our first night, we were turned away, unfortunately, from a few places and we couldn't find anywhere. And we asked a passerby if there was anywhere he might recommend for us to stay outside in Zurich. And he kind of laughed at us and said, you've come to the wrong country for something like that, my friends. And it turned out that the police in Zurich have the habit of patrolling the hiking trails to put on-the-spot fines to people sleeping outside. So even on our first night, we ended up...
It's illegal to sleep outside in Zurich.
Yeah, pretty much. And that was an immediate shock to us that we realized. It kind of added an extra dimension to the initial part of the trip, at least. He led us to it like... this old abandoned camping site nook that was wedged under a railway track beside a river, just surrounded by some bushes, and gave us the assurance that we shouldn't be disturbed there for the night. And I think it was at that point that I realized, yeah, this is real.
I mean,
were
you cold?
Cold enough, I think. It was, we had to make sure to put some layers on at night. But
yeah, wear all your clothes.
Pretty much. And thankfully, this was being done over the summer. I don't think we would have made it out if it was over the course of winter.
Yeah.
But we ended up sleeping in a variety of locations. We slept in a storage container one night. We slept in a medieval market hall on another night. We ended up running around Brugge that day trying to find a place to stay before ending up in the cellar of a swimming pool. There was another night where we arrived. It really shows to our planning of the entire thing. We arrived in what we were hoping to be the town of Weisenstein, having done a 7-hour hike through the mountains, only to find that Weisenstein wasn't a town, but it was a hotel that was closed, a restaurant that was closed, and a farm. And I just remember looking at Conrad and just saying, we've got one chance at this. We've just got one shot. And thankfully, a very kind farmer put us up in his tractor shed for the night, which was great.
Yeah. And of course, when you're sleeping outside or you wake up when the sun comes up, like you don't have curtains kind of keeping the sunlight out. So you're up at the crack of dawn.
Absolutely. And we found that that worked the other way as well. So we're up at the crack of dawn, which in fact we didn't mind too much because especially given the heat, we really hoped to cover as much ground as possible early in the day. So that come the midday heat, especially in the once we hit France when it was about 35 and it hit 40 at one point, that we could get out of the heat and we could chill out for a bit.
Yeah.
But even on the other side, when especially in summer when the sun wasn't setting till 10 o'clock at night, you might find a place to stay outside at around 8:30 at night, and then suddenly it's right, so what are we doing now for the next hour and a half until, because no phone, no reading material, no laptop. Of course, Conrad and I were talking plenty throughout the day, but we obviously, you know, as time went by, would run out of things to talk about, or we would have intentional times of silence as well. And so we were really trying to have to adapt to the weather and adapt to the elements as we went by. But we had a very varied and colorful daily sleeping arrangement. It was under a bridge one night. It was in someone's garden another night. It was in the Tate Pilgrim Barracks or the retreat house of the Mount Carmel sisters another night. Yeah. So we really saw plenty of Switzerland and plenty of Eastern France.
Could you tell us about your stay with the sisters?
Yeah, sure thing. So that took place in the town of Mizil. And before that, we'd received a tip from someone in Tournus saying, yep, go to Mizil. You'll find a very hospitable convent there. But on our way to Mizil, we started hearing a lot of mixed messages. We heard from some people that there was a monastery. We heard from some people that there was a cloister. We heard from some it was a convent. We heard nothing at all from other people. And so by the time we got to Mizil, we had a look around. And we saw a big hill in the distance, big monastery-looking establishment on top of it. And we thought, well, that ticks every box. That must be it. So we walked all the way over, about 1 to 2 kilometers up, and arrived to find that, yes, there was in fact a monastery that was indeed very hospitable, but only until the time of Louis XVI of France. where all of the monks in the area fled in the wake of the French Revolution. And there was one gentleman there who lived with his wife who had bought the premises, converted it into his dwelling essentially, and was living there, but was still giving random tours to people who would come by thinking it was a monastery or had heard that there used to at least be a monastery there. And so I had a very heartbroken tour, and I was a very demoralized tour as he was showing me where this monastery used to be and showing where beds used to be and food used to be cooked as we were exhausted and starving as well. And it was just as we left that Conrad kind of dejectedly, very much matching my own emotions, kind of said, "I don't suppose you know if there's anywhere for a bit of food or that we can stay here for the night." And the owner just looked at us and said, "Yeah, of course." And he pointed at another gigantic hill about 2 kilometers away, another monastery looking establishment on the top, and said, "Yeah, and Carmel Sisters, you should go over there." And I just remember going, just thinking, "Oh, Conrad, we're on the wrong mountain." We climbed the wrong. There was a bit more, let's say, French involved in my description at the time, but it was. But so we went all the way
Sacre
down. Exactly. So we went all the way down, walked all the way across, and walked all the way up again, and arrived again. We thought we missed the boat because it would arrive just after the opening hours and the reception had closed. And we knew that Mount Carmel Sisters are in general cloistered, and
Cloistered, yeah.
no way that we were going to suddenly barge in the middle of Vespers and ask for help. But thankfully, the lay governess of the convent found us and told us that some retreatants who were being hosted there would be invited into dinner soon into kind of an outhouse, and a sister would be there who was in charge of the day of all the guests, and we could come and make our case, so to speak, for a bit of help. And it was truly one of the most remarkable moments. The door opened and sister came out with an amazing smile on her face, arms wide, and just said, "Come here, tell me what's happened, what's going on." At this point, this was late in the experiment and late in the game, so we looked like we'd been on the streets for three and a half weeks. And immediately it was, come in, help yourself to all the food we have. Come in, we can definitely find a room for you." And that was a beautiful moment and just exceptional charity, just without question. I imagine we were quite the shock to the people making the retreat to suddenly see two very disheveled, demoralized people plonk themselves down at the table and eat everything in sight. But we tried to remember our table manners at least.
One of my memories of the pilgrimage was that it wasn't just the obviously you're looking for food and for shelter for the night, but you get as much from like the welcome and the generosity when the food and the shelter is given lovingly and generously, and you're like, "Thanks so much." It really lifts your spirit, and it helps you to keep walking, to keep going. It's not just about the calories.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it's just that feeling of when you turn up at someone's door, there's not a whole lot you can offer. Sometimes we were able to say we might be able to help out or do something in the garden, but you are coming saying, "Look, we have no money to offer you. We've very little ourselves that we can give, but we're asking you for help." And we received so much charity that wasn't just, "Oh, here's a bit of food," or "here's this," but it was, "Come into our home, sit down, tell us your story." That wasn't just limited to one region or one town, but we experienced that over the course of the month. And that was something that I have to admit that really defied my expectations. That really, looking back over the month, we were helped more than we were turned away. And even when we were turned away, we very rarely went empty-handed. It was usually with some kind of recommendation or at least a prayer to say that, "Godspeed, sorry that we couldn't help you, but we respect what you're doing and fair play."
Best of luck. Okay, so geographically, you were on top of hills and the bottom of valleys as well. Would you say spiritually as well? Like it was, there were ups and downs as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, in terms of our kind of general day to day, I mean, never have I more clearly seen God actively working in our lives. And I suppose the pilgrim experiment, you can look at it as an adventure. You could also look at it as an opportunity for providence. It's an opportunity to say, "Look, God, I'm giving up all of these normal day-to-day supports and I'm really relying on you, but simultaneously I'm going to be aware to that. I'm going to notice that, see that, and certainly grateful for it as well." So many times we were in the right place at the right time, or someone found us just as we were in a really, really tough spot and gone either hours without food or not slept at all a night due to being caught in a rainstorm or a lightning storm or something like that. I mean, there were great highs as well, staying with the Mount Carmel sisters in that very prayerful and very quiet environment. It was really nice, especially in the run up to Pere Le Monial, which was it was great to start to kind of gear into that headspace a bit. Staying in Taizé as well for the night was also completely improvised, but that was another great opportunity to go there and to also share our story and hear the stories of others there. In
Yeah.
Pere Le Monial itself, naturally, our kind of formal conclusion was at the end of Sunday Mass after we arrived. The Jesuit community there invited us up for a public blessing, kind of marking the formal end of our retreat, which
Yeah.
was that was an
Yeah.
exceptional, powerful moment. But of
Yeah.
course, I mean, you don't get the positives really without the negatives. And when you're walking for 6 to 7 hours a day and you're in a quiet period or you've run out of things to say, things aren't going good, you might not have eaten, it's hot, you're tired. Suddenly those voices kind of start to creep into your head. Either there are immediate doubts, it kind of begins with those saying, what if this doesn't happen? What if that doesn't happen? But then
Right.
when you exhaust those, it's not just a case of, oh, brilliant, I'm fine again. Then start tackling from new angles. You know, why are you doing this at all? Why are you here on this experiment? You know, what's the
Yeah.
point of all this? And it's
Discouraging
really
thoughts.
absolutely, absolutely. And sure, one of the core parts of our charism and our spirituality is the discernment of the spirits, is the discernment of what's bringing me and orientating me towards God, and then what's taking me away and orientating me away from God.
Yeah.
And in the same way, this was an opportunity for providence. I would say this was an also a real opportunity to have a real amplification of that day-to-day movement of
Yeah.
good, bad,
Yeah.
positive, negative, consolation, desolation. And there were some days where we spent whole days in desolation, just feeling completely hopeless about everything. But that's where I personally was very grateful for being able to do this with and fellow novice. And we made sure that kind of we begin every day and we finish every day, not only kind of checking in with each other on a one-to-one kind of communicative level, you know, how did
Yeah.
I communicate with you today? How did we plan that as superior, for example? How did I make decisions and how can we
Right.
improve? And but also, you know, checking in as well on a spiritual level as well, kind of how are you dealing with, you know, I assume you're in the same boat as I am. So how did you find
Yeah.
today? But that was a great joy to do on the positive days.
So even if you were having a bad day, demoralized, yeah, it sort of helps if the other guy's having a bad day too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
At least we're in this
Exactly. It's
together.
always something.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's always one of the things we always try to tell ourselves is, I'm sure this will be a great story for when we come back.
Yeah. Brilliant.
This would be
Brilliant.
something to share over a
Yeah.
meal in the Jesuit community. And of
Yeah.
course, as well, we had two fellow novices who were walking a similar trail between Bergamo and Laurent in Côte d'Azur in France. And so we were kind of joked to ourselves as well, always, how are they getting on? What are they
Yeah.
doing? And it was also great to constantly keep each other in our prayers as well, wondering where they were at their time. And, you
Yeah.
know, so even though we
Yeah.
were apart, there was a feeling that it's not just us doing this. There are other novices, not only in this province, but also around the world, embarking on some kind of crazy
Yeah.
pilgrimage adventure somewhere. And so it was a real
Yeah.
source of community as well.
It's a real rite of passage for us
Absolutely.
all. I don't know if you could say in a few words, how has this experience changed you?
Yeah, sure thing. I suppose certainly on two levels. First of all, certainly in terms of image of and relationship with God, I mean, it really brought to the fore for me how God moves and acts for me and for us, I'd say, in general, in day-to-day lives. I mean, that's a key part of learning discernment, especially that the focus of that is to the fore at the minute now that we're in the novitiate. But sometimes you can be tempted to say that, you know, God is only there for the big moments, the big decisions, and the lightning bulb moments. But really, God takes an active interest in every aspect of our lives, every decision, how big, how small. And sure, maybe on the pilgrim experiment, as I said, it was an opportunity for providence. It was an opportunity to say, God, I'm trusting you, but I'm looking forward to seeing how you're going to get me out of this one, so to speak. But then being able to take that and take that more acute awareness of discernment and the movement of those spirits back into kind of day-to-day life and applying that to my, let's say, day-to-day life in the novitiate.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose on the other, on another level, in terms of kind of relationship and with other humans and other people, and the German word Menschenbild, or your image or picture of humanity as such, it just, I mean, I'll admit it, as I said before, I began this pilgrim experiment, let's say, maybe with low expectations and not coming from a bad place, but I personally couldn't get it into my head how two young men in their 20s who I certainly, for most of it, didn't speak the local language, would just show up on people's doorsteps or stop people in the street and say, "We have nothing to offer you. We're making a pilgrimage. Could you please help us?" And just shocked that people of all creeds, all backgrounds, all contexts, rich or poor, where whatever it be, all different perspectives in life, everyone really showed up for us. Everyone really took the time to see us, not just as people asking for something, but as people in need, I would say. And yeah, just that experience of just pure charity with no expectation of something in return, that experience will stay with me forever, and certainly is, I pray, will play a big role in my vocation going forward and how I can hopefully give back in this vocation as well.
Great. Well, that's quite a important change, those two changes, like your image of God and also your image of people in general. There's a lot of goodness out there. There's a lot of charity out there. And yeah, sometimes you just need to ask.
Absolutely.
And are you happy now to be back in Innsbruck?
Oh, absolutely delighted. And it's thankful and as grateful as I was for the experience. It'd be almost like, I think our novice master joke with us would be keen to do it again. Well, of course, we never say no to anything, certainly not in this vocation. It's almost like asking someone at the finish line of a marathon, are they ready to run it again? So I was very happy to take a bit of time to just to catch up on some sleep, to recover and relax. I remember reminiscing with Conrad and kind of looking back at all the Dodge moments and just thinking, I think our guardian angels might be unionizing after this experiment. Completely overworked and just put to the shoulder of the wheel. But yeah, I mean, it's been great. I mean, we came back, we can settle very gently into novitiate life once again. It was great to catch up with the other, their fellow novices as well.
And Sean, do you have new novices who've joined you in Innsbruck this year?
Absolutely. We've had two new gentlemen who have joined us to form our new novitiate community for this year. We officially kicked off with the new novitiate year, let's say, yesterday, the weekend before our former second year took vows and has now kicked off his studies in Paris. And so, yeah, we've spent the past week now reflecting on the year, similar to now, highs and lows, where was God, where is God leading us in the vocation? I'm delighted that I'm still not only continuing to discern and continue to test my vocation, but very cheerful and very at peace for doing so. We're now marching forward with next year of novitiate, looking forward to new challenges, new graces, new experiments coming down the way, and then, yeah, seeing what surprises kick up and make known throughout the year as well.
I think that's a good image to end this episode on. Marching forward
Oh,
into
yeah,
the second
absolutely.
year of your novitiate, and hope you might be able to march over to Ireland at some point this year. We'd certainly put in a bid for you to come over and do one of your experiments here. But Sean, listen, it's been great talking to you, and we'll be sure to have you back in the podcast again. And we wish you good wishes and every blessing for the second year of your novitiate. And thanks everyone for listening again, for tuning into Sons of Ignatius podcast. It's good to be back, and we do our very best to keep the episodes flowing. Okay, take care, everyone. God bless. Bye.